Welcome to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates. We have a great vocation story today. I always love sharing stories about vocation, how someone chooses or how God chooses vocations for people. It's always a question of who chose that vocation. Obviously, God chose that vocation for us, but uses these earthly things around us to help us see those vocations, and looking forward to sharing a great vocation story with you today. Thanks to our underwriter, Concordia University, Wisconsin, for supporting Worldwide KFUO, especially for supporting Faith and Family. You can find out more about them on our website. Go to the sponsor section on KFUO.org. Look for the CUW logo there. You'll find more information about Concordia University, Wisconsin. Joining me in studio today, seminarian Paul Flo. Paul, welcome to Faith and Family.
Thank you, Andy. Thanks for having me on the show today.
Absolutely. Glad to have you in studio. Thanks for being our guest and sharing about your story as a seminary student at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis with a unique education opportunity as a seminarian. Looking forward to sharing that today. Before we get into your special opportunity for study as a seminarian, tell me a little bit about Paul Flo, and we'll lead up to what led you to consider this vocation of pastor and seminarian.
Sure. So let's see here. I come from a family of six. My father, Pastor Stephen Flo, came out of Fort Wayne in 1990, took his first call to Grace Lutheran Church in DeSoto, Missouri, and he's been there ever since. So 26 years at the same place. It's been a huge blessing. My mother, Kimberly Flo, is the organist at the church, mm-hmm. and wonderful to have her as a mom at home whenever we were growing up. That was an extraordinary blessing. I've got two older sisters, Kari and Kaya Flo, and my younger brother, John Flo, is right here in St. Louis with me, going to medical school at St. Louis University. So it's been nice to have some brother time, mm-hmm. living in the same apartment, not getting too sick of each other while I've been here at seminary.
Well, glad to have you in studio today, and looking forward to sharing your story. When did you first start thinking about this vocation of pastor? I mean, growing up with your dad, what did he do before seminary? What was his vocation? What was his career before? Yeah.
Well, actually, he just worked for a couple of years in the admissions office at Lutheran Bible Institute up in Seattle. And during that time, he became more interested in learning more about Lutheran theology and decided to come to seminary. So he didn't do, after school, he didn't do too much before mm-hmm. he decided to come. And actually, it was kind of the same situation with me. Growing up, my dad never put any pressure on us to be or to consider the ministry. In fact, he said, God will get you there if he wants you there. So don't try to urge that, or don't try to push that. Don't jump into it. It's a serious calling. And so I was actually a teacher for a few years. I taught on the Big Island of Hawaii for 2 years, a fourth and fifth grade math and science. And then I did 1 year of abroad teaching English as a second language over in Malaysia. And so I was very certain that I was not going to be a pastor. I wanted to carve my own pathway, and a little rebellion against doing anything similar to what my dad did. And it wasn't until maybe the third year of teaching that I thought, okay, I'll go back to the seminary just to study theology because I'm really passionate about Lutheran biblical theology, but I don't want to be a pastor. And now here I am preparing for my vicarage as I continue to be formed into a pastor for the church. So I always think that God has a wonderful sense of humor, and he likes to show me that I can plan my steps, but he'll actually get me where he wants.
So you had the opportunity to teach in two kind of unusual places. You got to teach on the Big Island in Hawaii, and then also taught English as a second language in Malaysia,
yes.
correct?
Yes.
Tell me about those experiences.
Sure. So the first program was with Teach for America is the name of the program. I graduated from the University of Missouri Columbia in 2010 with a degree in psychology, and I knew that I did not want to do any more schooling for a while. I was very sick of it. So Teach for America sounded interesting to me, and it was an opportunity for me to try something a little different. I've always loved teaching, partially because I've got a younger brother who I was teaching a lot when I was growing up. And so I decided to try that out, and that kind of brought me into the world of education without having the traditional teaching background. So there was a really good opportunity for me, and I ended up really loving education. Got my master's while I was out there, so I didn't actually take a break from school like I had planned. And then it wasn't until maybe the second year that I was starting to have second thoughts about whether I wanted to teach math and science. I knew that I wanted to teach, just not sure what. After the 2 years in Hawaii, then I applied for a program called Fulbright, and that brought me out to Malaysia with 75 other English teachers from the States, and teaching English out there in a small village called Besut, up in northeastern Malaysia, pretty close to the Thai border. And that was the third and final year that I decided, you know, I think that I want to study theology. And if I want to be a teacher, then I want to teach something that I'm really passionate about. So that's kind of how I started getting the idea to head back to the seminary.
Who did you meet along the way that was the were there people that you met that shaped these decisions, and the students, the other teachers along the way that you met?
Yeah, good question. I think that for my 3 years of teaching, it was more of the lack of Christianity and the lack of a Christian community that I had that really started making me ask some big questions about my upbringing and my faith. But I also don't want to, you know, minimize the impact that people have had on me over the years. It's hard to choose one or two, just many different people who have either said things like, oh, you've got a lot of good insights when it comes to theology, and I think that you would be a good pastor, and you're good at listening, or just little bits of encouragement along the way. And then, of course, God working just in my own life to draw me to him and to create this passion in me for really sharing the pure gospel that the Lutheran Church has been blessed with.
What did your family think when you first went to Hawaii to teach and then Malaysia to teach, traveling all over the world? What did they think about that?
My family's always been really, really supportive. I'm not scared to say how much they're going to miss me, but they've never hampered those sort of opportunities because they're going to miss me. So they've always said things like, we're going to miss you, but go for it. Go take these opportunities and hopefully we can come out there and visit you, and just very supportive parents. So I've really appreciated that.
So you came to Concordia Seminary in St. Louis to study theology. Not really sure if you were planning on being a pastor or not, right, but came to study theology.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Actually, I originally, when I was talking to my admissions advisor, I was fairly certain that I was not going to do the MDiv because I knew that was more of a pastoral formation program. I was going to just do the MA so I could study theology. And by the time I, you know, was talking to other people, I decided to just go for the MDiv. And after a year, if I really decided that I did not want to do pastoral ministry, then shift gears and just do the academic program. But again, God's got a good sense of humor, and it seemed like after a semester even, actually we're on the quarter system, so even after one quarter, I thought, okay, I'm just going to kind of give in, and I'm going to pursue this, and if he's got different plans, he'll change them again. But right now it feels like at the time I felt as though it was a really good fit, and I wanted to continue down the pathway toward pastoral ministry, and feeling very good about it now, excited about my vicarage experience coming up.
And we'll get to vicarage in just a little bit. But you had a unique opportunity, even before vicarage, to study. Tell me about when you first learned about this opportunity, this fellowship to study in Germany.
Sure. So this was just a couple months ago, and it was a two-week program called, the acronym is FASPE, F-A-S-P-E. It stands for Fellowships at Auschwitz for the Study of Professional Ethics. And I was first made aware of the program by my spiritual advisor at the seminary, Dr. Bruce Hartung. He put it on the daily announcements, and I saw the opportunity, and I thought, well, I don't know anything about it, but it sounds really amazing. And so I ended up applying and managed to be accepted as one of the 2016 seminary fellows, which was a really big surprise to me, but also just I felt very humbled to take that opportunity. So it was a two-week program, 1 week in Berlin, and then another week over in Poland, starting out in Krakow and then going up to the Polish town of Oświęcim, or the German pronunciation Auschwitz, and then going and visiting a couple of these historical concentration camps, Auschwitz and Birkenau.
What was it about this program that intrigued you enough to pursue it?
Well, I really liked the idea of, first of all, just visiting these sites that we learn about ever since we're younger in our history classes. But then also such a program that takes these historical events, but then tailors them to a seminary group, I thought would be really not only inspirational, but also very important for the future, especially because ethical issues are always going to be available and, you know, facing us. And so a program that really tailored these events toward discussions that are relevant to seminary students who are going to be leaders in their community, spiritual leaders in their communities, really intrigued me.
What did you anticipate that you would learn, that you would bring back, that would really equip you as a future pastor?
That's a good question. I don't think going into it, I knew what to expect too much. After I was accepted, I found out that I was the first Lutheran in Missouri Synod to go, and so I really didn't have anybody to ask about the program. So I knew that I was going to be studying ethics from within the context of these World War II Holocaust events, but I didn't know what to expect. So it was, I think, beneficial in that way, because I could kind of go more as a blank slate without any sort of expectations and really be pleasantly surprised with many of the things that I experienced and took away from that program.
Anything you needed to do to prepare?
There were quite a bit of, in terms of the interview process, it was just the typical physical application you send in, and then the phone interview. And then in preparation after your acceptance, they give you three books to read and probably about 200 pages of articles just to kind of get your brain wheels turning and set the historical foundation a bit before you get there. So that way the places and the topics that we're discussing really are able to kind of take root in what you've learned before that.
Now, you mentioned you were the first LCMS student to study in this program. Tell me about coming into this study with other students coming from other worldviews, other ethos, other theological and confessional perspectives.
Yes, so there were 12 fellows in the seminary program. Three of them were rabbinical students from various rabbinical I don't know if seminary is the proper word for that. And then the other nine were coming from various Christian theological traditions. And that was one of the aspects of the program that I thought was so excellent, coming together and really realizing that as a Missouri Synod Lutheran, there are certain things that I felt, wow, I really have something to add to this discussion. And on the flip side of that, really had a lot to gain from these other theological perspectives that have sometimes very different views on, basic topics that were relevant to this experience, like forgiveness or like hope in the midst of tragedy, these sorts of things. So it was really fascinating to go, and I think it was a good time to go as well, because I had 2 years of solid Lutheran theological training, and then going with that to be exposed to many different perspectives on these issues was a really enriching experience.
Tell me about some of the first sites that you got to visit and learn. What were some of the first places you visited?
So as soon as we flew into Berlin, we immediately, we had a wonderful tour guide that was with us the whole time, Torsten Wagner. He's a professor in a couple different locations in Europe and also in America. And so we did a Berlin tour right away. The biggest part of the tour was, of course, stopping at these sites that were relevant to this part of history. So going to the Topography of Terror Museum, going to the various memorials for different groups that were victimized during this time, particularly the memorial to the murdered Jews of Europe was a very fascinating memorial. We took a couple day trips out to very interesting sites like the town of Wannsee, which is where the Wannsee conference happened. This is a really nice, really beautiful mountain kind of resort area where some of the top Nazi officials came together to decide on the final solution to the so-called Jewish problem. And it was really amazing to be in this just picturesque resort area, imagining some very powerful people at this time just deciding on a whim to get rid of, to exterminate such a huge number of people. So places like that, there was also one site that has stuck with me quite a bit, was the Euthanasia Museum in Brandenburg. And this was a place where the Nazis had their euthanasia program, where they first started experimenting with gassing of humans. They started with people who were disabled in various ways. And this is when some of these experimentations were taking place, which were the precursors to mass murder at these sites like Auschwitz and Birkenau. So that's kind of where we started in Berlin. And then once we got to Poland, then it started kind of building. The program was tailored in such a way that it kind of built up to visiting the sites of Auschwitz and Birkenau.
How, as you visited these places that are so significantly associated with death and with evil, how did you deal with the emotion of it all as you visited each of these?
And that's one of the aspects particularly that I thought it was so beneficial to have a variety of traditions there. The three Jewish students that were there, and then our program was led by two leaders, one priest and one rabbi. And just to see the different, just the spectrum of emotions that all of us were feeling, and particularly for the Jewish students to be there and to have such this emotional response really moved me to feel more emotion, because I realized how personal and how much this affected them as individuals. One thing that struck me is just being in these places where you're seen and you're walking on the same pathways that this happened just, 70 years ago. It really was, really difficult to try to think of explanations of why this could happen. And it really brought up a lot of questions in all of us, about how we deal with things like the discussion of God and his omnipotence and why he would allow certain things like this. And it really, it brings about a lot of emotions that you don't experience whenever you're discussing these issues from the safety of, a classroom, across the ocean in a small town, Missouri.
Did you find that, that biblical approach to sin and evil, that biblical understanding in the conversation, were there other voices that brought that to the conversation? This understanding of, what the Bible teaches us, God's word teaches us regarding the fall into sin and original sin and the sin problem in general. Did you find that in the conversation, or was that something you brought to the conversation?
Yeah, both. Yeah. The conversations were really enriching, and I felt as though I had things to offer, but I was also really amazed with what my fellows had to offer. And one conversation that has stuck with me quite a bit is after we visited the Auschwitz II, which is also called Birkenau, we were discussing the topic of hope in the midst of such atrocity. And one of the rabbinical students, she said, after experiencing this, she really has to believe in a redeeming God, because she felt as though there wasn't any room for much hope in this context. It was just a pit, she said, just a dark pit without light, without hope. And she said that I've got to believe in a redeeming God, because humans are just totally incapable of redeeming themselves. And I thought, how profound is that coming from a Jewish student? And it fits so perfectly with our biblical understanding of Jesus Christ, coming to fix humanity because we are not able to fix ourselves.
But we're so caught up in our sin. We're just so, so burdened by our sin that we are incapable.
Right.
So sin-ridden. Yeah.
And I think these historical events like this, they remind us of the darkness of our sin, because given our circumstances and our place in life and the time period that we live in, sometimes that evil that exists in all of us is really contained. And so we have these little glimpses in history like the Holocaust, where the mindset of the time and the people in power allowed this evil to kind of come forth. And it's a good reminder of what really exists at the bottom of human nature. And it's a very scary reality. So being in these sites really... you have to face that in a very much more personal way than a more vivid way than you face on a day-to-day basis.
On one hand, it's very frightening to realize what we are capable as humans, what we're capable of. At the same time, it also shows us what we are incapable of as humans as well.
Right, right. Yeah, I was thinking a lot about that. Even here in the States, it seems like every time a tragedy happens, it's kind of a it wakes us out of this kind of stupor that we're in, and it makes us realize, oh, life is really fragile, and that could be taken away from me at any moment. And it really makes people start asking questions that we tend to kind of push aside whenever we're kind of going through our daily routines and we don't think about very often.
Certainly. I mean, very easy for us to just go through our daily routines and not think of these things, especially our own ability to, or our inability to do anything that doesn't involve sin.
Right.
In and of ourselves.
Yep.
So you visited, let's go back to the places you visited. We've been to Auschwitz two now.
Yep. So Auschwitz was a series of camps. Auschwitz one is what people would usually refer to as Auschwitz. And then mm-hmm. Auschwitz two is also called Birkenau. The first one was a much smaller camp. And the second one is mostly ruins now because a lot of it was the second camp was built a lot quicker because they needed the Nazis needed more space. And so it was a camp kind of built on a whim. And so a lot of the buildings are collapsed now. And a lot of it was a lot of it was also destroyed. Mm-hmm. So that way, you know, evidence could be minimized. So it was interesting just to see the magnitude of that second camp, Birkenau, right in the middle of this beautiful birch forest area. That's why it's called Birkenau, birch. And just to imagine that these mass murders were happening right here in this, again, very, very beautiful area of Poland.
In visiting the sites, did you ever study or discuss the rise of the Nazi regime, what led up to this? Or was that part of your study before you even
Yeah, a little
visited?
Bit of both. Those topics came up. And that was another thing that stuck with me quite a bit is sometimes, at least in my ignorance of history, and again, studying these things only in textbooks, I guess I sort of imagined that it was just normal, civilized society. And then, bam, then you're in the midst of just mass murder. The Nazi regime is in power. But it really didn't happen like that. It was a slow progression of evil. And that was one of, you know, sometimes people, now that I'm back, they'll ask me, what are some of your big takeaways from this? And that really is one of the major ones, is that Satan always introduces evil in gradual steps. It's never such a shock to people. And this is exactly how Hitler and the Nazi regime worked. They would move forward and then they would stop and kind of test out the ground a little bit and see if there was much of a pushback. If there was, then they would wait or kind of back up a little bit, wait for people to become more desensitized to that and then move forward again. Mm-hmm. And then they would stop and wait and move forward again. So what would happen is these small evils would be introduced. Life would be minimized. And then people would become desensitized to it. And then the ante would be upped. And so it's this very slow progression that allows such craziness to, you know, such evil to really happen. And sometimes it's not until later, or maybe it takes even another culture, another part of the world to say, wow, how did you guys end up here? Because the people in the midst of it sometimes are a little bit blinded to the evil that's going on around them. And I think that's something that every culture, of course, can learn quite a bit from, including us here in America.
Kind of a slippery slope. Take a few steps, see if there's pushback. And then once the culture is desensitized to that, move forward, progress more with it, especially regarding the issue of life, human life, that is given by God and valued by God. And how we just have disregard for it, or we as humans believe that we can determine whether or not it's valuable,
right?
Which ones
exactly,
are valuable,
right? That's actually one of the most fascinating and kind of vivid memories that I have from the trip, is being at this little tiny museum, this little memorial, the euthanasia memorial right in Brandenburg. And this wasn't even part of the tour, but we had a little free time to kind of wander on our own. And I was in the corner with some headphones and looking at this video that was playing. And it was a video from Nazi propaganda, basically showing these disabled patients. And the way that they were talking about them as patients, as people, was really quite frightening to me, because it sounded exactly like much of the rhetoric I've heard, even from peers in my culture here in America. And so they would say things like, look at this disabled person. They have to be led out into the yard by two nurses. They have to be seated because they can't even seat themselves. And they have to have a spoon lifted to their mouth and they have to be fed. And isn't it so tragic that they live a life like this? And then they would move into, this is, you know, how much money it costs to maintain a life like this in 1 year. Just imagine how many healthy German families we could support with this amount. And that's, again, thinking about some of the conversations I've had with peers just in the last 5-6 years. It's always that same sort of rhetoric, that same sort of speech, kind of wrapped in kindness and a little bit of sympathy, but it's how evil gets introduced. It's how a minimizing of human life gets introduced. Because then the next question is, well, who decides whose life is worth living? Who decides who's living a miserable life or not? And of course, history tells us that it's the people who are in power. In this case, for the fellowship, it was the Nazis. So it's that really has stuck with me quite a bit, because it really reminds me of some of the discussions I've had with people about abortion and euthanasia here in the United States.
Physician-assisted suicide.
Exactly, right? And even the word euthanasia, good death, coming from two Greek words, it's somebody else living a so-called good life or healthy life, deciding that somebody else's life is not worth living and deciding to be merciful enough to let them die a good death. It's just, it's really playing God. It's taking life and death into our own hands.
Have we learned, what have we learned then from the Holocaust, from the evil of the work of the Nazis? I mean, if we haven't learned that,
yeah,
and we're still continuing that same worldview, that same approach to life, and that the people in power get to decide which lives are valuable, what have we learned from it? We'll get to that in just a little bit when we come back from our break. We're talking with Paul Flo, seminarian from Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, on his recent study on the role of clergy and ethics in Nazi Germany. We'll be back in just a moment.
Concordia University, Wisconsin in Mequon overlooks a half mile of beautiful Lake Michigan shoreline. CUW campus is located 15 miles north of Milwaukee, with over 70 undergraduate majors, 28 graduate degree programs, and doctorate programs in pharmacy, physical therapy, occupational therapy, and nursing practice. CUW offers online learning and accelerated learning at one of 9 Wisconsin centers and one in St. Louis. Traditional or accelerated education, CUW has the program for you. CUW.edu.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, president of Life Issues Institute.
Much is being made about Hillary Clinton being the first woman presidential candidate, but that's wrong. She's the second. The first was back in 1872 when Victoria Claflin Woodall ran for president of the United States. Victoria and her sister, Tennessee Claflin, were the first female stockbrokers and invested in their own newspaper. Woodall wrote several editorials on the right to life of an unborn baby. The rights of children, she wrote, then as individuals begin while they yet remain the fetus. Being pro-life was one of her strong campaign issues, again writing, "Whoever has read The Weekly knows I hold abortion to be just as much murder as the killing of a person after birth is murder." So I guess Hillary Clinton is simply repeating history, not making it.
Like us on Facebook at Life Issues and stay informed, more informed than you've ever been.
Worldwide KFUO Salute Our Day sponsors on this Monday, August 22nd, 2016. Today's Day sponsors are Bob and Nancy Claus. Today's Day sponsors have made a contribution to Worldwide KFUO to encourage listeners to Google the Wittenberg Project. Once again, we say thank you to Bob and Nancy Claus of Chesterfield, Missouri. Today's worldwide KFUO Day sponsors.
Hi, this is Pastor Mark Azil, the LCMS Director of Campus Ministry and the Chancellor of LCMSU, inviting you to join us right here on Wednesdays at 2 p.m. in the Student Union. If you can't make it, Student Union is always available as a podcast at kfuo.org. Learn more about LCMSU at lcmsu.org. And remember, college is tough. You need Jesus. We'll help.
The Student Union is underwritten by Lutheran High School Association.
Join Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service and thousands of congregations across the country as they observe Refugee Sunday, a time to celebrate the gifts migrants and refugees bring to the United States. Pick a Sunday that works best for your congregation to celebrate. New resource kits, including bulletin insert and poster, will be available soon. Sign up for our newsletter at lirs.org/rebuildinghope.
Colossians 3:23 says, "Whatever you do, work heartily as for the Lord and not for men." Kelly Schumacher, artist and founder of Agnus Dei Liturgical Arts, offers group and private lessons in classical art education that focus on Old Masters oil painting techniques and drawing that glorify God and are based on the fundamental principles of art and art history. Youth and adult lessons are available. AgnusDeiArts.com. That's AgnusDeiArts.com.
The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod celebrates and affirms life from the time of conception until natural death, and every time in between. For this reason, LCMS Life Ministry is a program singularly devoted to upholding the sanctity of human life, both in our church body and the culture at large. Life Ministry provides educational materials, hosts conferences, and works closely with allies such as Lutherans for Life. For more information, visit lcms.org/life and follow LCMS Life Ministry on Facebook.
Welcome back to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates. We're talking with seminarian Paul Flo about his recent experience studying on the ethics, the role of clergy and ethics in Nazi Germany and the Holocaust. And before we went to break, talking about the comparing the views of Nazi Germany and what we witness and what we hear in American rhetoric today when it comes to valuing life. And it's frighteningly similar. Yeah. Paul, who are some of the others who were you were studying with? Obviously with other seminarians, but were there others involved in this program as well?
Yes. So FASB, they have about five different programs that go every year. So they have a seminary group, they have a medical group, they have a journalism group, a law group, and I always feel like I'm missing one more. But anyway, over the years that they've had this program, they've experimented with different pairings, which groups kind of seem to be a good fit together, mm-hmm. in terms of joint discussions, that sort of thing. And they've decided that seminarians and the medical group usually go really well together. And I think the one thing they've mentioned is because both of these groups are dealing with health, physical health and spiritual health. And so we were paired with, so there were 12 seminary fellows and then either 12 or maybe 13, I can't remember exactly, medical fellows as well. And so we were paired together. Most of the program was tailored individually, so we would have most of our sessions just with the seminarians. But once in a while, we would come together for a full group discussion. And it was really enriching to have these future doctors there to contribute to this discussion.
What did you learn from the medical fellows?
I think that a lot of the same discussions were had. The ones that have stuck with me, they also contributed quite a bit to. And just in terms of what we were discussing before break, of the value of human life, as people in the medical world, they're the ones who are most exposed to issues like abortion and euthanasia. And so quite a few of them were able to contribute to that exact discussion of what is this slippery slope, as you mentioned, making decisions on which life is worth living or not. They were really able to contribute quite a bit to just that whole discussion because they've experienced more of that in their training.
What did you learn about the role of clergy and the church in Nazi Germany?
So The program was, it was interesting. Well, let me start by saying that there were certainly clergy members and also churches who were very active in opposition to the Nazi party, most notably in the Lutheran tradition, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. That's a very famous name for us. But the program was taking a quite different perspective than typical. So instead of studying these events from the victim's perspective, FASB was trying to study the issues from the perpetrator's perspective. So really asking questions of what sort of mindsets were in place and what sort of justifications were being made to allow people to participate in these things. And so those topics came up quite a bit, and questions of why did clergy not step in more? And because the vast majority of them were not very active in opposition. There was one really interesting discussion that was had. There was a, we read about an interview, a pastor who was interviewed and basically asked that question, you know, why did you not stand up more? Why did you not fight back more? And he said something that has stuck with me again. He said, I was not going to be a hero in this situation. And when we first hear that, we kind of think, well, that's kind of cowardly. But I think the point that he's making is whenever there's a lot of fear involved, it's really easy to kind of turn a blind eye to things and to say, well, my family's safe, my congregation's safe, I'm safe, and therefore I'm just going to kind of stay out of it because this is my flock. You know, I'm not, that's not my job over there. It's really easy to kind of shift responsibility. And, basically take part in terrible events through sins of omission rather than commission, as we sometimes talk about.
Hmm. How did, what effect did Nazi Germany have on, you mentioned that, you know, the kind of the congregation or the pastor who was indifferent. What effect did it have on the families in those congregations? What did you learn about the lives of families in those Christian churches?
Yeah.
Did you learn anything about how, you know, what this meant at home?
I can't think of any specifics there other than similar situations where people are, they kind of have this feeling that something's not really right, but it's, I think one thing that has stuck with me again is this, just the power of fear to keep your mouth quiet because you're scared of, if I say something, then I'm going to be the next victim. And so whenever you're not the one on the bottom, it's really easy to just kind of passively move on and turn a blind eye to things.
Sure. You know, thinking of, what were parents encouraged to teach their children? What did children who grew up in that era learn from their Christian parents or from their pastor regarding the Nazi party, the Nazi regime?
I think that one of the huge influences during this time was the use of propaganda, Nazi propaganda. One of the museums we were at, it was the Wannsee Memorial, not memorial, just the Wannsee Museum, where this decision for the final solution of the so-called Jewish problem happened. There was quite a bit of kind of placards on the wall, on the walls of various Nazi propaganda. And to think about how much that, in the same way that media influences the way that we think today, even Christian families, of course, because we're exposed to these things as well, to see the sort of messages, hidden messages or not so hidden messages that were kind of implanted into people's minds through propaganda. So I remember one poster that showed some, you know, two beautiful, healthy, white German parents, and then how they have a couple kids, and then it showed on the other side some distorted, unhealthy looking people. And they had like, it kind of showed their family tree and it had like 20 children. And it said something like, the impure races are reproducing so much quicker than healthy people. And if we don't do something about it now, they're going to be taking over our land and taking our children and taking our daughters. And, you know, this sort of thing, it's fear tactics really. And so there's no doubt that even Christian families are susceptible to those sorts of fears.
Did, in your studies, in your conversations, did the topic of Martin Luther come up and in regards to the Nazi party?
You know, it actually didn't. And I was really shocked by that. One thing that I realized once I was there is a lot of these Christian denominations really don't know much too much about Lutheranism. And then, to be fair, as they were talking, I realized I don't really know too much about some of their denominations. And so that was a big eye-opener to me of the need to have more dialogue. And that doesn't mean compromising our religious convictions and minimizing our differences, because those certainly are important, but to talk about them more. But I was surprised that that didn't come up, just because there has been quite a bit of discussion and writing about Luther and some of the statements that he made about the Jewish population. But no, that didn't come up at all.
That was exactly why I asked. You know, it's my understanding that Nazis, there's discussion about the Nazis using some of Luther's writings as justification or fuel for their position. And
yeah, actually, that didn't come up even at the museums, where there was a lot of displays talking about Nazi Germany using Christianity to support their crimes. That didn't come up. What did come up is this discussion of the Jews are the ones who crucified Jesus. And so as the church, as members of the body of Christ, we need to stand up and support them, support the church, and support to show glory to Christ, basically, by punishing them for that. That sort of mentality was definitely used by the Nazis, but not so much, at least in the discussions that we had, not so much Martin Luther.
Which is clearly neglects the scriptures and what Jesus said about himself,
right?
First and foremost, that no one takes his life from him, but that he lays it down of his own accord. And secondly, that without his death, there would not be Christianity.
Right. Exactly.
two huge points that I think would be are being overlooked.
Right. And that's one thing that came up in my mind, is if that sort of argumentation is so against the biblical teaching, how are people able to kind of internalize that so much? And it makes me think that there were many different complex factors going into the sort of cultural climate of the day. One thing that came up quite a bit was after World War I, the kind of destitute stage or state that Germany was in, it led to this sort of wanting to be great again and wanting to rise to the top again. And so they really needed a scapegoat. And so I don't think people even cared too much if something was theologically accurate, as long as it reinforced their need for a scapegoat, you know. So it was kind of like, actually, this came up quite a bit too, of the Nazi Party using Christianity as long as it benefited them. But then as soon as any sort of Christian group started talking in opposition to them, then immediately they would turn on those groups. And that's why certain pastors like Dietrich Bonhoeffer were killed for that exact reason. So it's not that Nazi Germany was Christian. It was, they were willing to use Christian as a powerful social force whenever it benefited them.
How did, in your discussions, in discussing the Holocaust, and we talked about this a little bit earlier as well, this understanding of evil, how did everyone try to work out that understanding of evil and how something so bad could happen? Why would God allow something like this to happen?
So that came up particularly, and we had a discussion on faith in the midst of atrocities like this. And it's always interesting to read different firsthand accounts from these events. So, for example, books by various Holocaust survivors, you'll hear them talk about how some of the people that they were side by side with totally rejected God, totally rejected faith. And then others seemed to be strengthened in their faith. And it seems as though this is always, you have this dual reality in the midst of any tragedy. Why faith is minimized in one person, maximized in another person in the same situation, I don't know if we have any answers to that. But that definitely happened. And so there was a discussion on how this, all of this affected the image of God and God's omnipotence. And that's in theology circles, and at the seminary, we call this theodicy, defending God in the midst of trials and terrible events like this. How could God allow something like this to happen? And there are some groups that try to answer that question. And I think Lutherans take the better approach of saying we don't know, we don't have all the answers. Why does an omnipotent, all-powerful God allow these things to happen? We don't always know. All we can know for sure is that he is working all things together for good for those who are called according to his purpose, and he has reasons, but we don't know. So ultimately, we fall at the foot of the cross and look at Jesus Christ, who took all of that evil upon himself, and that's kind of where we stop.
We'll get to what you took away from this experience, this learning, in just a little bit. What do you think others walked away with from this learning experience?
Yeah, that's a. I've really been wanting to. Now that we've been back for almost 2 months, I've been wanting to contact them. Now that people have had some time to process things, even though we had quite a few discussions, reflective discussions while we were there. I don't think that people were able to really process all of it. It was just so much to kind of take in all at once. But I already mentioned the girl that mentioned that she has to have a redeeming God because humanity is incapable of redeeming themselves. That has really stuck with me. Another person really brought up the discussion of not trying to, kind of what we just talked about, not trying to explain evils that happen, but just to sit back and realize really how helpless we are and how few answers we really have a lot of times. And so he was reflecting on his future pastoral position and how he's going to handle people who come to him and say, "Pastor, how could this happen to me?" And instead of trying to insert an answer, walk with the person and suffer along with them and again, fall at the foot of cross, at the cross and look to Jesus Christ. So different people voiced how these experiences were kind of shaping the way that they would see themselves interacting in the future with their parishioners.
How do you think this will shape you as a future pastor? How do you think this will impact your vocation as a pastor or maybe as a teacher or a parent perhaps in the future? And when that young person comes to you and says, "Pastor or dad, Why does God allow evil to happen like this in this world?" Yeah. When he or she sees some atrocity like this.
Yeah. I think, again, for me, my temptation is always to insert or say a little too much because I want to have an answer. You know, as pastors and even as Christians, when we're interacting with someone who's in pain, we want answers, of course. So I think one thing similar to the gentleman I just spoke about, I think for me, my hope is that I will say less whenever there's less to say and just be with the person and grieve with them, cry with them, walk with them, pray with them rather than trying to explain or understand. And that's, again, whenever you're at these sites where such crazy evil occurred, it almost, you know, when we're having these group discussions and some of these students that I'm with are in tears because of what they've just witnessed, it's really almost offensive to just step in and say, "You know what, it was bad, but God had good reason for it." It's really hard to say that when you're really in the midst of tragedy, and it's, again, almost offensive. It doesn't feel right to do that. So to fight the temptation to answer and just to be there with my parishioners in the future. That's one thing. The second thing would be to really educate my future congregation on the importance of stepping up and facing even the seemingly small injustices that are happening in our own communities, precisely because of what we've already talked about of this slippery slope. Whenever we let one injustice kind of go by and we say, "Well, that's not that big of a deal," then that's how evil works. Then it's going to be, the ante will be upped. And before you know it, you're in the midst of something that you didn't think was capable before.
As we start to justify one injustice or one disregard for human life, we welcome that into our way of thinking, and then we just continue to do that slowly so that from one generation to the next, we end up with this just ungodly view of life.
Right. It really reminds me of how easy it is for humans to just drift away in all sorts of directions, and the importance of having a rock solid foundation, a standard by which to judge things, namely God's word. Without that, it's kind of like the standard now is the cultural climate or what I personally want, or, you know, you're thrown into all sorts of moral relativism, and there's nothing sturdy, no standard by which to judge these things. That's definitely a necessity for us as humans.
Anything else you think you'll take away from this experience and how that will shape your future education, preparing for vicarage now? Anything else from this learning experience, from this fellowship, that you think will shape the rest of your studies and future vocation?
Yeah, some of my personal reflection on my own ability and just the human ability to justify our sins has really kind of popped up in my mind quite a bit. We studied during one session the Stanley Milgram experiment. I don't know if the listeners are familiar with that, but basically there was this psychologist at Yale University. It was a few months after 1961, a few months after Eichmann, one of the Nazi SS leaders. He was being tried in Jerusalem for his crimes, and this study started to test people's ability to kind of justify themselves by saying things like, well, I'm just obeying orders. And it was really amazing to see the human ability to do that, to shift responsibility and to forget that if you don't speak up against something or take action against something, you are also complicit in that evil. Again, going back to what we mentioned before, sins of omission. Sometimes for Christians, and I can speak mostly for myself here, it's easy to say, well, I haven't done this and this and this. I haven't committed these sins. But then what about all the sins that I have committed because I haven't stepped in? That's something that has really stuck with me in my own personal reflection.
Would you encourage others to apply for this fellowship in the future?
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm shocked to hear, as I'm asking around the seminary, that most people have never heard of this, and I've really found it to be just an incredibly shaping experience, influencing experience for me. And so every single year they have the program for, again, seminary, medical, journalism, law, and so I'm really encouraging people to apply for this. It's a wonderful program.
What's next for Paul Flo?
Vicarage. I've got a two-year vicarage in the Dominican Republic coming up. I'm in the process of support raising for that. I think I'm about 60% funded at this point, and so I'm hoping maybe by the end of September to be heading down and to start working, spreading the gospel of Jesus Christ down in that part of the world.
So you'll be working with a great team in the Dominican Republic, other missionaries already there serving and well prepared to serve, and just a whole new adventure awaits you.
A big adventure and lots of Spanish learning to come.
Yeah, I'm sure you learned a little bit of German. You studied some German while you were...
Not too much German there. While I was there, I was continuing my Spanish learning, trying to prepare for vicarage a little bit. So I'm plugging away, but yeah, lots of adjustments and lots of challenges ahead.
Is there a way for us to follow you and your preparations for your service in the Dominican?
Yes, I don't have any sort of webpage or blog set up quite yet, but lcms.org/flow, I think, is the site where you can learn a little bit about this vicarage and even partner with me in this mission if that's something that you're moved to do.
lcms.org/FLO, right?
I think that's right.
Very good. Good way to follow what's going on with seminarian Paul Flo as he prepares to serve his vicarage in the Dominican Republic. Thank you so much for taking time to share your story with us today and for sharing what you learned in this wonderful fellowship opportunity.
Thank you for having me, and I pray that this whole discussion was enriching, beneficial for the listeners in some way.
Absolutely, certainly for me, and we'll share this and more information on our website as well, and you can find us on social media as well on Facebook. You can find us there, maybe catch a picture or two from our studio time today. Seminarian Paul Flo, Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thank you very much.
Come up in just a little bit, Thy Strong Word. You're listening to Worldwide KFUO.
Listen to Faith and Family Monday through Friday at this time. Faith and Family is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for Faith and Family to continue. Our address is 1333 South Kirkwood Road, St. Louis, Missouri, 63122. You can contact us on the web and download Faith and Family at KFUO.org. Worldwide KFUO, on the air, online, and on demand.